This is The Takeaway with Tanzina Vega from WNYC and PRX in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
Let's be honest. There's a lot of heavy news out there these days. And something I like to do to get away from current events is look for a good laugh. But here's the problem. The conversations happening about comedy today aren't always so funny.
There's a creepy PC thing out there that really bothers me.
It's a nonsense to believe that some people deserve never to be offended their whole life.
Are we going to go through everyone's history? Or are we going to get rid of every sketch that SNL has done that involves race?
We're not running for office. When is this going to end?
It feels like we can barely go a week without hearing comedians, mostly male, complain about political correctness and how there are just too many lines you can't cross. And while the lines are clearly changing at the moment, not everyone is feeling limited by these new rules.
There's people who are going through more traditional channels and people who are taking over alt spaces or people who are just making videos in their mom's house with their mom's wigs, and then all of a sudden they're like the most famous person on the planet.
As the barriers to entry to comedy shift, some women of color are finding their voices heard in ways that seemed impossible 5 or 10 years ago. So we're going to talk about it. This is Laughing in Color, a special podcast from The Takeaway. We'll speak to some of the women of color stand-ups and sketch performers who have shaped the world of comedy, and we'll hear from younger comics on how the landscape is changing for them. And one question at the center of it all, whose moment is it in comedy today?
It's anybody's game.
It really belongs to people like Ali Wong.
Two people, Robin Thede and Tiffany Haddish.
This is Eddie Murphy's moment right now. Two dope queens, I love them.
Obviously there's Hannah Gadsby.
I still think it's white men.
Anybody can step up and say, I'd like the mic now, please, and have an audience.
Just some of the voices we'll be hearing from. But before we get into the modern era in comedy, we have to go back all the way back to the 1950s.
The comedy world in that time period was very different than it is now, but it was also kind of the beginning of the framework for how we think about comedy now, which is stand-up and sketch. And so in New York at the time, there were, you know, the big clubs like the Copacabana, but there were also all these smaller clubs. And so if you were a woman, you were most likely playing at one of these.
That is
Yael Cohen, the author of We Killed, The Rise of Women in American Comedy, and the arts and entertainment editor at the Wall Street Journal.
Yael says that a whole range of factors made it difficult for women to break out in the comedy world of the 50s and 60s.
It was the nightclub bookers. It was the audiences. It was, you know, ideas about what women could and couldn't talk about, what they should and shouldn't talk about. The idea of what it is to be a funny woman, all of those things, I think, created just all sorts of barriers.
And of course, there was one harmful line of thinking that still exists to this day.
There was the idea that women weren't funny.
In the middle of the 20th century, a small handful of female comedians did start to find success, but nearly all of those women were white. One of the few exceptions on mainstream comedy stages was the black comedian Moms Mabley. Listen to her riff on marriage on The Ed Sullivan Show in 1969.
But mom got broke, and the wintertime coming on, didn't have no money, and I married another old man. Older than the other one. Older than his birthday.
Even as more opportunities opened up for women in comedy in the following decades, the racial demographics pretty much stayed the same.
I think especially in the early and mid-90s, there was still sort of that ethos of there can only be one.
And that's
Soraya Nadia McDonald.
She's a culture critic for ESPN's The Undefeated. Soraya says that when she was growing up, the most popular woman of color in comedy by a long shot was Whoopi Goldberg.
Okay, like my boyfriend's really cool, okay? And like he's, no, he is. He's like totally cool. And like I totally love him. But, like, you know, he, like, had a job, like, at Goodyear, you know, because, like, the Goodyear blimp, you know, would last forever. But, like, it lost air, so, like, he totally lost his job. And, like, I mean, like, I was so, like, freaked out because, like, I said to him, like, it's only, like, temporary, you know? It's, like, not gonna last. But, like, then, like, today, I started freaking out because I thought, God, when does temporary become, like, permanent, you know?
Whoopi Goldberg just had this sort of, like, fabulously weird quality about her while also being just really welcoming at the same time. I remember like studying her performances and just both the physicality and the way she wrote her humor. She was just like side-splittingly funny to me.
In the 80s and 90s, women like Marcia Warfield, Wanda Sykes, and Margaret Cho were also getting their big breaks. But throughout all of these successful comics' careers, even they've had to toe certain lines that white comics rarely needed to consider.
When it comes to women of color, and black women in particular, it's a power dynamic of like, am I going to tailor myself to the room, or am I going to expect them to come to me?
We're going to start by talking about one of the most dominant institutions in comedy to this day.
It's Saturday Night Live!
The show has often been referred to as a boys' club, but for women of color, it's been a particularly unwelcoming environment.
You sort of realize that you as a black woman are like this scarce entity. There's all of this additional pressure on your shoulders that isn't necessarily applied to your castmates. Even as someone as beloved and popular as Maya Rudolph has talked about, you know, feeling like an outsider when her colleagues would make fun of her hair, you know, and the fact that it took longer to like straighten and basically get her camera ready than it did for her counterparts.
Culture critic Soraya Nadia McDonald again. And while SNL frequently failed to resonate with her when she was growing up, there was another sketch show that did connect. Created by Keenan Ivory Wayans, the sketch show ran on Fox from 1990 to 1994, and it launched the careers of big-name stars including Jamie Foxx, Jim Carrey, Jennifer Lopez, and Rosie Perez. It was also where comedian Takiya Crystal Kima got her big break. One character Takiya created was a young girl named Chrissy, who created an alternate reality she called Black World.
In Black World, all the black people have the money, and your mother doesn't have to sit and stay up in the theater and clean up late at night while you have to sit and wait and be quiet, and then you're sleepy. And then when you go to school, it's no rats in the corner and no mice either, and the books are brand new and they have pictures of black people in.
At the time, a character like Chrissy on In Living Color was not a character you'd necessarily expect to see on a show like Saturday Night Live. But by the early 90s, SNL did add Ellen Cleghorn to its cast, and she became the first black woman to stay at SNL as a full-time cast member for multiple seasons.
Ellen, are you all right there?
You know, you think with all the crap on TV that they would leave one or two good shows alone. But no! They had to go and take Full House away from us. I can't believe it.
I spoke with Ellen and Takiya to find out what it was like for them to headline two of the most popular sketch comedy shows of the 90s. And Takiya started out by telling me how she carved out a space for herself on In Living Color.
On the show, certainly at first, I wasn't given lead roles. I was given girl number three, woman number four. And I was able to take that and create whatever I wanted, which was more fun than being given a lead of a character that was already created by somebody else. And then often, more often than not, Keenan would come over and say, who is that lady? Okay, yeah, I want to see her again in this sketch or that sketch. So that was the best compliment that I could get on the show.
Let's talk about one of your characters. Chrissy was one of the girls that you played on in Living Color.
Yeah, so I'm the reason that how she got on the show in the first place, because she used me for the first audition, and they really liked that. And when for me, that was the thing that was better about in Living Color than Saturday Night is because it had a lot more black people on it.
What did Chrissy mean to you, Takiya?
Chrissy is me at 5 or 6. She's a lot of little girls that I know. I created Chrissy when I realized that my niece Robin had the same revelations at 5 or 6 that I did, that the world wasn't quite about her. And that feeling being on the precipice of acknowledging racism and how you fit into a racist world when you're a child and how you translate that is fascinating to me. So Chrissy allows me to say what I think about the world in innocence.
Ellen, you got your break on Saturday Night Live, another show that's been around for a little over 40 years now. And it's been a predominantly white show throughout its history. What was the audition process like for you in terms of really breaking into SNL?
Okay, so here's the deal. On the week before I auditioned for SNL, I was auditioning for In Living Color.
Get out of here.
And I was in the room with Jamie Foxx and Marlon Wayans, I think, was auditioning that season. So I didn't get it. I got on the plane back and I'm devastated that I didn't get In Living Color. I laid on my sofa and I was talking to the Lord. I lived on the first floor, so I couldn't even jump out the window.
Well, you could.
But I could. But to what end?
Wouldn't have the same statement.
Exactly. And nobody understand. I don't think you understand the devastation unless you have been through it. And so I went ahead and picked up the phone. My agent was calling me. Okay, this is what you're going to do. You're going to go to Saturday Night Live. You're going to do your characters and blah, 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 blah. And then I went ahead and, you know, went in and auditioned. It was a different audition than In Living Color because you actually worked with others in Living Color. And then at SNL, you did your thing by yourself on the stage. And so I did two characters, my Zoraida the Page character and Queen Shaniqua. And then they called me back. And I was like, what? The first day I showed up to work, who's there? Michael Jordan. Can you imagine? And then I think on the same day, Jesse Jackson was on the show. And I was like, where the hell am I? What is this? This sorcery, this witchcraft. But it was wonderful. It's magical.
Now, you go on. You're now part of SNL. You're part of this magical moment. Were you allowed to be the characters that you wanted to be? Were you free to sort of get out there and really feel like you were on equal footing with other members of the cast?
Yep. Sink or swim, you better swim. And I got to write a lot. And I got to be Natalie Cole. They were very shocked, but they were like, okay, if you suck, you're going out, you're out the door. But yeah, I did get a lot of sketches that I wrote on, and it was... It was interesting, but I did not know the total history of it, like that there had never been a black woman cast member. Like there have been women on the show like for a season or for a couple of episodes. But as a cast member and as a writer, no. And I didn't know that it was uncharted territory.
Ellen, for SNL's 40th anniversary special in 2015, you did a bit with Jerry Seinfeld. Let's take a listen to that.
I want to know, why aren't there more black women?
Oh, you mean on Saturday Night Live?
No, in general. No, because I was in the dentist the other day, and I went in, and there was only like one or two black women. I was like, what? You know? And I said, wouldn't it be really cool if like there were more, like there were black women just like popping up out of the drawers and stuff?
Yeah,
that would be really
absolutely.
Cool.
I'm for having black women everywhere.
Great, cool. So how many black women were on the Seinfeld show?
SNL has had a dearth of black women on the show. I mean, I remember, you know, just back in 2013, there was this whole brouhaha because, rightfully so, because, you know, ultimately there was no one to play Michelle Obama. Where do you think, I mean, what's the legacy here that SNL has had with black women performers?
Let me say this. Mm. So in 2007, I went back to school, got my master's degree at NYU. And then in 2015, I got my PhD in comedy from the Performance Studies Department at NYU. So what I do is I look at humor and rhetorical functions and, you know, the way we use comedy and black women and black women in comedy, just people in black people in general doing comedy, and that's my focus. But what you're asking me is, and it really kind of pains me a little bit, because we always want to point a finger at somebody so that we could blame them for whatever, whatever. In Living Color, I was on the show. I did 2 episodes before I auditioned to be a cast person. And it was a wonderful experience to work with all these black people. Our problem, we always have to say that we are complicit in our own subjugation. We want to point to these white people who have a show and say, you're my problem, or I want to be where you are. Well, you're not going to subvert that. That's not never going to happen. Let's look at what's for real though. There's never been a black woman in the White House. When they say, okay, in the White House, okay, in government, we've had a surge of women. This year we had so many women. No, but those were white women. We still are sorely underrepresented in the Senate, in the House of Representatives. When you want to point the finger at SNL, is that the real problem that I should be concerning myself with? I don't think so.
I agree with that. As an outsider, grew up watching Saturday Night Live, saw myself as a child on Saturday Night Live. I wrote imaginary letters to Lorne Michaels where I said, you know, let me be the first child on Saturday Night Live. But I never, you know, and when this brouhaha happened, I thought, this is their art. You can't, you know, I think it's wrong to infuse yourself in someone else's art. It's kind of ridiculous to me. It's as ridiculous as if someone had gone to Kenan and said, I'm going to demand some more white people on In Living Color, have some more Asian people on In Living Color. It's, you could, but this is my art. I'm not looking at Saturday Night Live for the black woman. I'm not. I watched it when Garrett Morris was the only person of color on the show and, you know, missed me in the way that I missed me from everything, but didn't ever think that I was entitled to be on that show, even though I wanted to be. I never felt like I was entitled. And I think it's, you know, pretty egregious for us to, you know, protest someone's art because it doesn't include us. Make your own art. If you're missing yourself from the cultural landscape, then present your own art as a part of it.
When both of you look at the comedy world today, whose moment is it right now?
I think it's whoever takes the mic. I really do. I think it's always been that. And I think that we tend to wait for our turn. We tend to see what's out there and say, oh, that's like me. Maybe I have a chance. But I reject that notion. As I've been performing him since I was, you know, 3 in my grandparents' living room. So I've never waited for someone to give me permission to take stage. I think that we're living in a very isolated, segregated society where there's movements of continued segregation and movements of inclusion, even if it's just to say we are, we want to be politically correct and say we want diversity and inclusion. But during this chaos, anyone, it's like the California election where Schwarzenegger can get in. It's anybody's game. Anybody can step up and say, I'd like the mic now, please, and have an audience.
Ellen, whose moment is it in comedy right now?
Can I make it a 2-parter?
Absolutely.
Okay, part one, this is Eddie Murphy's moment right now. Eddie done come back on the other side in the second part of my thing. There's these black girls who are doing this stand-up comedy on the internet and on HBO. They are wonderful because they say everything I say is valid. Every feeling that I have is valid, and we're going to talk about every single moment of my life in the same way that white folks think everything they do is spectacular. This needs to be written about. I'm like, really? You had a pizza? Okay. Let's write a movie about it. So I just think that they're validating themselves in this new media moment where all these girls on the internet. They are so funny. And the HBO Black Girl Show, comedy show, is really, really good. And the Two Dope Queens, I love them. And you say you didn't wait for permission, but I always need permission. So they give me permission to say, oh, what you do is amazing. Just go ahead on and do that. So I just think it's wonderful that these little Black Girl Magic kids are doing their thing.
Those were comedians Ellen Cleghorn and Takiya Crystal Kima.
My name is April, and I'm in Tampa, and I think the person who has killed me the most often is Eliza Schlesinger. She is hilarious and on point for everything topical that's happening now. Love her.
Hi, my name is Frankie. I'm calling from Olympia, Washington, and right now I think it is time for queers and women to have their moment in comedy. Been run for way too long by white men, which is really boring. In Seattle, Washington, my favorite comedians are Val Nigro and Clara Pluton.
Hey, this is Seth from Hannibal. Dave Chappelle is the current godfather of comedy, but Nikki Glaser and Sebastian Maniscalco are both underrated trailblazers in American comedy today.
This is Cami Bonaducci calling from Sun City Center, Florida. Without a doubt, it is Chelsea Handler lately. She's awesome. She's funny. And she touches on all the right subjects.
My next guest, stand-up comedian Margaret Cho.
I really am Korean, but I have met people more Asian than me. I met a girl, her name was... I was like, oh, that's pretty. Do you spell that with a C or...
Margaret Cho is really more spiritually a 90s comic.
That's Yael Cohen, author of the book We Killed, The Rise of Women in American Comedy. And she says that Margaret was part of a wave of comedians who broke out by doing things a little differently than her predecessors.
That was the beginning of the alternative comedy scene, the group of people who kind of came out and said, we're not going to work in these comedy clubs anymore with a 2-drink minimum and a door fee. It was just too expensive. My friends can't go to it. It was also required a certain kind of joke style of humor that they were growing out of.
And for Soraya Nadia McDonald, culture critic for ESPN's The Undefeated, Margaret's work stood out for more than just its unique style.
She was really sort of brash. She was always open and welcoming to queer people. And she was always willing to talk about her experience, like being the kid of immigrants and what that was like.
I make fun of my mother a little bit, but I am so excited to share my success with her. You know, she didn't want me to be a stand-up comedian because she experienced so much racism and hatred coming to America in the 60s that she just could not believe that this country would accept her child. So the fact that I can be successful means to her on a very fundamental level that America somehow works and that things are getting better in her lifetime.
But by the time Margaret Cho was making it big, she had already been doing comedy for years. She was just 14 when she first stepped onto the stage.
We had a teacher who would sign us up for open mic nights at this club called The Other Cafe in San Francisco. And it was a place where you would go to see all sorts of people like Bobcat Goldthwait or Dana Carvey or Paula Poundstone. And we got signed up for their open mic nights and we would do these performances there. You know, it was odd because it was at an adult nightclub, but we could be there because we were performing.
And when Margaret was first starting out, she says she rarely crossed paths with other Asian American women in the comedy scene.
I felt like I needed to figure out a way to accept that I could be in comedy and not have to really ask anybody permission or not necessarily to have anybody who had sort of paved the way for me. You know, other than women in comedy, of course, there were many women in comedy who I looked up to and who helped me actually a lot. But there were no Asian American women and very few women of color. So it was a really isolating experience, but at the same time, it was a good test in kind of seeing how brave I could be and to really explore. Nobody told me I couldn't do it exactly. It was just that I never saw examples of people like me doing it, but I just went along with it.
A couple years ago, I interviewed a performance artist who uses a lot of humor in her work. Her name is Christina Wong, and she's out in, she was at the time out in California. And a big reason why I was attracted to interviewing her was because she played on and really, you know, took on head on, if you will, the stereotype of white men who fetishize Asian women. And that was a big part of what she did, just trying to go against the whole docile, you know, Asian woman that's fetishized in this world and in this way. You said that you're willing to play off of Asian stereotypes in your work. How do you do that? How do you balance that?
Well, I love Christina. I think she's great. And I think it's really mostly just about adding a voice to whatever we regard as stereotypes or whatever we regard as these archetypes of people that we're sort of supposed to be or that mainstream culture designates us to be. And I think that the whole thing about submissive Asian women to me is quite a myth because I know relatively none. I don't think any of us are very, very docile or submissive, but there's sort of a fantasy that's kind of projected onto us. I think that maybe that they wish we were like that. I don't know. But it's fun to talk about it because it's like we have so little representation and then the ones that we have are really inaccurate. And so to play into that and to make fun of that, I think is really empowering and fun.
Now, we've seen even more recently Ali Wong, who's been both on television and she's just written a book and she's done a number of Netflix comedy specials. And her thing, or one of her things, is to really go into intra-Asian relations in her comedy, right? And talk a lot about things that perhaps, you know, a lot of folks in the audience may or may not be familiar with. Do you ever think about that, like how Asian audiences respond versus non-Asian audiences to that work? Or is it a question of really trying to have to appeal to white audiences versus other types of audiences?
I mean, I think that we have to look at the particulars of our culture. And even if the audience isn't necessarily always going to understand right away, it's the explaining that makes it really fun. And to understand the subtleties that exist within Asian Americans and within the different Asian American people, like, you know, I think it's really funny. And really, there's a lot of really astute observations that she makes. There's so much prejudice and colorism and judgment and internalized racism. It's a very complicated issue, you know, that we can be perceived as other by mainstream culture, and then we other others. It's really like, where does it stop? It's really funny.
Do comedians of color more broadly, and or do you feel that women of color comedians or you know, people who are non-white comedians, is it their responsibility to have, does their work have to mention race? Does it have to have a focus on race, or can it just be something that has nothing to do with race and still be funny?
I don't really know. I think that race figures into my personal life, my daily life, so much that it's hard to think about writing without that perspective. Like, we don't have that privilege to think that race is unimportant because it informs every interaction that we have, whether we are really aware of it or not. It really does. And so, you know, to use that awareness as an artist, I think is really important. I don't know if it necessarily is required from, you know, different performers. I think it's up to the individual. But for me as an artist, like, my writing couldn't be removed from my racial or ethnic or cultural identity. Like, my queerness, my gender, all of these things inform my worldview. And so I think it's just something that I would consider important to talk about just because I understand it affects me a lot.
We're in a moment right now, and part of the reason why we're exploring this topic in particular is because a lot of the conversation, you know, around comedy right now has been focused on men.
Yes.
It's been focused on male comedians. You know, I'm thinking Dave Chappelle in particular, who and others who have been, you know, sort of pushing back on this idea of quote unquote PC culture and woke culture and, you know, what they can and can't say. What's your thinking on that? I mean, is comedy, you know, one of the last places that should be touched when it comes to what people can and can't say? Should people be apologizing for, you know, routines that they did decades ago?
I think it depends on the artist. I think it's really up to them and their own conscience and what they feel about what they've said. And the thing about comedians is that you can't tell them what not to do, because they'll just do it. You know, the more somebody tells somebody not to do something, a comedian not to do something, they're going to do it more and more and more, because we're always trying to challenge the status quo, challenge people's thinking. I do think that woke culture has gone a long way in helping the way that we can equalize the world, that we can look to other and kind of become each other. And I think that's really important. I think that equality really begins with language and the way that we address each other. And then from that, it's really kind of up to people to decide what to do with it. And comedians are really rebellious. They don't want to be told what to do. They don't want to be defined by a culture. And so they're going to push back no matter what it is. It doesn't really mean anything other than we just are that way. And we're iconoclasts, I guess. That's what it is. It's something that we just are by nature, and the profession is by nature. So we're just going to reflect what's happening in society and in a very oppositional way.
And isn't there a part of that line of thinking, too, in terms of the saying the thing you're not supposed to say, that audiences gravitate to, that allows, you know, for some of that humor to come through, and some, even if it's uncomfortable? You know, I'm sure all of us have found ourselves, or most of us at least, have found ourselves laughing at something that we're like, I shouldn't be laughing at that, right?
Yeah, it's really naughty. It's really a way for us to be, you know, mischievous. It's a way to be, to get around the rules, to bend the rules. If you're clever enough to be able to make a joke about something that nobody wants to talk about, then you're kind of proud of that. Comedians are secretly proud of being bad, and we want to be nasty. It's just part of the nature of comedy, and it's really down to your skill on whether or not you get away with it. I think with Dave Chappelle, I mean, he's so good at what he does, he can kind of get away with anything because of the skill that is required to get around these subjects. So I think it sort of depends on who it is and how good you are at kind of letting that get through all of our own perceptions, all of our own filters, you know. And it doesn't work to have no filter, as we've seen a lot of people go down that, and it's hard. So it's about finessing it. So I think that's really what is important.
But do you feel, Margaret, that there are certain lines that you can't cross in your own work, or that you shouldn't cross, or that sort of keep you, you know, thinking, well, I don't really want to go there? And has that evolved over time?
I think it evolves. It's only that the only reason I wouldn't go somewhere is if I couldn't think of anything good enough to go there for. You know, like that's the whole point of it, is that if I can't think of something that is good enough to justify this terrible thing that I'm going to say, then I'm not able to do it. You know, it's really like I know my limitations as an artist and also kind of as a human being. So like I go, well, that's too deep for me, or this is too difficult, and I will stay away. Whether that is, you know, all of the different subjects that get people into a lot of trouble. Like, I think that I can talk about race to a certain extent. I can talk about gender to a certain extent. And there's things that I can really illuminate there. But then there's other places where I just don't understand. So it's hard. Like, I definitely think that you just have to be good enough to go there. And if you are, people appreciate it.
Another place that has been lacking in representation isn't just the comedy stage, it's also the television, you know, and TV. And we've seen that in particular. I mean, you tried doing an ABC sitcom called All American Girl. That was the first network sitcom to be led by an Asian American cast.
Well, I've got news for you, Mom. I'm American. Eric is American. Even Stuart is American. Tell her.
I'll try. Mom.
What happened to the show? I mean, did you and ABC not see eye to eye? Was it right show, wrong time?
No, there were a lot of different issues. Partially, it was the Korean community at that time had just come out of the LA riots. And so they were incredibly protective of their public image, because the only thing that people had seen of Korean Americans basically were Korean shop owners standing on top of their buildings in South Central with rifles. It was a weird time. You know, 1994 was a fraught time in terms of race relations in Los Angeles in particular. And so the Korean community really rejected my presence because I am such a raunchy nightclub comedian. They were resentful of the fact that I was not a man. That's a patriarchal culture also. They didn't like my values. I was queer. I was way too feminist and way too naughty for them to really embrace me. And so they were protesting around the show. The network were very uncomfortable with that. And, you know, so there was a lot of issues that didn't have anything to do with the show itself. It just had to do with my presence as an artist. But in Koreatown, you know, in LA, all those people that were angry at what I was doing, they all died. So now I'm the one alive. I'm the elder. And I'm really welcoming to all of these comedians like Ellie Wong and everybody out there that's doing it, like Awkwafina and Ken Jeong and all these great, great people. So I feel very happy to be in the elder position now.
Another show that has lacked in Asian American representation is Saturday Night Live. They were most recently in the headlines because of Shane Gillis after he made racist jokes about Asian people. At the same time, Saturday Night Live hired one of their first Asian cast members. I mean, where does SNL stand? Are they still relevant when it comes to, you know, being on their stage and, you know, having to have a full slate of representative cast members? Because we talked to one of the first Black women to ever be on SNL, and she was like, look, it's their show. It's not our show.
Well, they did a great thing in hiring Bowen Yang, who is a friend of mine and a great comedian, and he's done great on the show so far. I like it. I think it's a great show. You know, it's historic. It's definitely something that appeals to a lot of people. But at the same time, there's a lot of places where we can shine, and we don't have to judge ourselves by their kind of like, you know, rules or their requirements or what they want or what they're trying to appeal to. I don't know the exact like importance of it now. You know, I think that it's had a lot of importance over the years. It may have waned at times, but I still think it's a great show. I still think that they need to have more representation of other kinds. And, you know, they do listen to the world. You know, when people say we want more female representation, we want more queer representation, they bring in different performers. So I feel like they definitely are an institution, whether it's mine or not. I don't know. I should host it, though. That's what I've wanted to do forever.
And what are they saying? I mean, are they not extending the offer?
I don't know. They haven't yet. So I should.
What's up with that? It's been a while. I mean, you know, they've been on the air a little for over 40 years. I mean, you're an icon. Like, what's up with that?
I know. It's crazy. But when they had Awkwafina hosting, it was the first time in, I think, 26 years that they had had another Asian American host. I think the last one before that was Lucy Liu. So the long time, long time.
You can't see, but I just kind of dropped my jaw for a minute because that's kind of insane.
It is crazy. It is crazy.
Margaret, whose moment is it in comedy today?
I really think it really belongs to people like Ellie Wong. I think that she's really doing such a great job in kind of taking that comedic voice and lending it to different types of scripts, whether it's her own movie, like Always Be My Maybe. All the stuff that she's done with Netflix is really incredible. So I really am excited about that. I think she's really amazing. I think that there's a lot of different people that are doing great, great, great stuff. And so I'm really a fan of Ellie's.
And is there anything else besides SNL that you're looking forward to doing?
Yes, I do really enjoy doing stand-up comedy. And so I'm really out there on the road all the time doing that and doing different kinds of shows all over. I'm doing a lot more acting these days, which for me is really gratifying. I don't know what it is that's kind of made it possible for me to be doing that more. Maybe it's that thing of, you know, whether Crazy Rich Asians had a part in that, but it's really expanded the idea of where people want to see Asian Americans in media. And so that's been very, very helpful.
Margaret Cho is a comedian and actor. Margaret, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In 2014, stand-up comedian Cristela Alonzo became the first Latina to create, write, and star in a network sitcom, self-titled Cristela, which also ran on ABC.
She invited us to her granddaughter's quinceañera this weekend. She waited till the last minute so I would have no time to prepare.
Prepare? It's not your quinceañera. I mean, you became a woman hundreds of years ago.
But just like with All American Girl, the network failed to develop an audience for Cristela, and the show was canceled after a single season. And while Cristela didn't become a major network star, since then she's continued to gain a following through her stand-up. In 2017, her special Lower Classy premiered on Netflix.
I've been traveling nonstop for over a year, and I've seen all of the country, and wow. I was recently in North Carolina, and I went into this bar, and I asked the bartender for an old-fashioned. So he took away my voting rights. I was like, whoa, that's... Whoa. I'm kidding, I'm Latina, I don't vote.
Comedy has been a part of Cristela's identity since she was little. Growing up in a Spanish-speaking household in Texas, she learned English by watching television.
I loved sitcoms growing up, and I realized that I used to talk in the cadence of sitcoms. So a lot of my comedy, the thinking as a child, would come from sitcoms. Also, because I was learning the language, I learned to do voices by imitating people. So like I can do this kind of voice. And it was just like, you know, certain little things where I would hear people and I would start doing it because that's how they were speaking English.
But even as Cristela fell in love with comedy, it still took a long time for her to consider comedy as a career.
From my background, below the poverty line, blue collar family, working check to check, our jobs had to hurt. So for me, the idea that there was any job that was intellectual, that involved thinking, was so luxurious.
I sat down with Cristela to discuss how she established herself in the comedy scene and what lessons she's learned from her experience telling stories about a Latina family for a national audience.
I've been saying this for years. Everybody calls it the Latino community, and there is no country called Latinolandia. And the problem is, with a lot of representation, with a lot of projects, I see that a lot of the Latino community can't support certain projects that are Latino-based because it doesn't reflect their lives. So, you know, with my show, there were people that were saying, oh, well, my family's not like that. That's a stereotype of this. I'm like, this is my family. Like, it literally, you don't understand. My show is based on my family. My family's still alive. I have to answer to them if I was going to do something that exploited or showed them in a negative light or in an unrealistic light.
And white families in sitcoms on television have been able to be many, 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 many different things.
Absolutely. Right? And also when it comes to television, I think we can tell certain stories, but not all of them. You know, Latino stories have to be multi-generational. It's the grandmother, the mom, and that's how it's described, multi-generational, where we see a generation of the Garcia family. It's the grandmother, the mom, and the daughter, and blah, 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 you know. Okay, so it's a family. Now, why do we have to say multi-generational? And to me, I've always figured that it's because we almost assume that we're going to, our job is to teach. We have to educate. We can't have fun. We need to inform people. We have to tell them about our history. You know, we can't have an episode where someone wants to just go bowl. If we have that episode, there should be a monologue where I say, my mother came to this country so that I could bowl.
Do you feel that there are limitations like that in your comedy when you do stand-up comedy? Do you have more freedom on the stage?
Oh, more freedom. I mean, that's why I wrote the book. The reason I wrote my book is because I felt so stifled by network and studio trying to narrate my story into what their perception was, that I realized that comedy's where I'm free. This is actually an argument I had with the network, with the powers that be during my show. Now, I had problems with some of the writers on my show, with the network, with studio people, because, you know, they couldn't understand that my life was my life. There was a point in the year that my show was on where I had to explain to them, I want to remind you guys why I got this, why you said I got this show. You saw my stand-up. I had no dreams of getting a TV show. I was happy doing stand-up. People don't understand, when you do stand-up, you do the job that a network and studio can never do. You go do that research that they will never get, because you're going out and playing with an audience that isn't necessarily what is your quote-unquote demo, and you have to make them laugh. And I wasn't doing a Latino tour where I'm just hitting up, like, you know, like the tamales stands and everything. You know what I mean? Like, I was hitting everybody because I was doing a college tour where I was doing shows in Nebraska and Iowa and Michigan, Wisconsin. And I had to make everybody laugh. So, you know, for me, I found it so defeated during the show, where I thought, well, you said you wanted my stand-up, but then you don't want my stand-up. Like, you don't want that. Like, you're limiting what I can say and how I can say it. You know, if I tell you something that's true to me, you know, it's like there was this idea about, to me, food allergies are a luxury. And people, you know, they couldn't understand what I meant. And I was like, yeah, I'm not saying they don't exist. I'm not saying they're not real. I'm saying that when you're poor, you don't really have the luxury of learning that you're allergic to certain food, because you just eat when you can eat.
And you eat what's put on the table.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and if you don't, if you don't like it, you just don't eat. So it's that thing. How do I explain that to people, that this is funny to me because it's a different idea than most people know? You know, so right there, it's like, if they're telling me they don't get it, trust me on this. Like, this is, I have a whole thing about this. And they're like, no.
I mean, even now we see there are some lines being drawn, even in comedy, even mm-hmm. There's a lot of male comedians complaining about how, quote unquote, PC culture uh-huh. or woke culture uh-huh. Limits the jokes that they can make. And these aren't just white guys. I uh-huh. mean, there have been a couple, you know,
yeah.
without naming names. First of all, what's your take on that, the whole woke culture is taking over? And do you feel like there are certain lines when you're on stage that you cannot cross, you know,
right.
that are just like off limit?
I don't have a problem with the PC culture, woke culture calling me out. I think that our language evolves with time and we should be able to learn. I don't think I'm perfect. And I think that if I were to say something that was offensive, I would like to know, because if someone finds it offensive, it has to be for a reason. There are certain sitcoms from the 70s and 80s that if you see them now, you're like, whoa, like you could never get away with it. That doesn't mean that at that time it wasn't funny, you know? And it's that thing where you know better. But in order, we got here because that moment existed. Now, I will say, to me, I think that stand-up, I think that comedy in its truest art form is you being yourself and conveying your ideas. I think that the best chance you have of being successful in comedy is really being your most honest version of yourself. If you can really be honest about how you feel about certain things, you shouldn't be apologetic about everything, because that's the true sense of who you are. I do believe, though, that there's certain ways to express ideas that I always wonder, is that the best way to convey it? Is there a sharper way of conveying it? It doesn't even mean about like being offended or being crude. Is that the best word that you can use there? Is that the funniest word? Like, have you ever tried using a different word that might be funnier? You know, and that's just writing. Like in stand-up, you'll know. The example is, if you're going to do a joke about a bird, the word parakeet is funnier than bird. So maybe try parakeet instead of bird. You know, it's trial and error in stand-up.
I want to talk about women, particularly black and brown women in comedy mm-hmm. and money, because
yeah.
we know that matters, right?
Yeah.
In 2017, you released a Netflix special, Lower Classy.
Yes.
The next year uh-huh. after that, Monique was criticizing Netflix, uh-huh. right, for giving her or offering her what she said was $500,000 to do a special. And she mm-hmm. said, you know, Amy Schumer, Dave Chappelle, Chris Rock, they all made millions. How did you feel about your Netflix deal? You don't have to critique Monique here, but how did you feel about your Netflix deal? Do you feel like you're getting paid what you deserve to
I
be
thought I was
paid?
Getting paid. Well, here's the thing. Here's the catch. I have low self-esteem. So I always say that I have low self-esteem because it has half the calories of regular self-esteem. Now, having said that, I'm very hard on myself. I was very happy about what I got with my Netflix deal because I also know where I stand, meaning that when you're one of the first or only to be doing it, it is hard to get valued at what you deserve because there's no one before you to say, well, this person got this, then this person, you know, was it maybe 2010, I think, I got booked at a comedy club and I had to do Wednesday night through Sunday. I got a deal to do all those shows for $800. The regular rate is about $1,500 for someone on that level. You know, I didn't have a lot of credits. You know, my friend had just done that club and I asked him what he got. And that's when I found out it was $1,500. So my agent at the time, and this is when I'm trying to break into clubs, I complain because it's almost half of my friend. And he says, you know, the owner of the club doesn't think women are funny. So he thinks you have to go and improve yourself. At this point, I hadn't been doing colleges and I was really trying to get my feet wet and I needed to pay rent. And it was like this thing where I'm like, I had to take it because I didn't have any other choice. I did the week. It was awful. And I didn't headline that club again. That person ended up owning another comedy club. I want to say maybe like 5 years later, I play his other club. And I sell all the shows out and I get a bonus for every time I sell out the show. And he wrote the check out to me and it was gigantic. It was like a big amount for me at that time. But I told him, I'm like, I waited long to come back because I wanted to show you what I was worth. And this is what I was worth all along. And at that point, that was the last time I ever played that club. And I never did it again. And it was that thing where you gotta show people what you're worth at times. And it's frustrating because not everybody has to do that.
To wrap here, I want to ask you one question that we want to talk to all of our comedians about here. Whose moment is this era of comedy that we're in right now?
Oof. I'm going to say I still think it's white men. As a Latina, I will tell you, I think that a lot of the stories that I think we get to tell can be at times agenda porn, where we tell the same narrative because that's what they think is funny. And we are not allowed to really explore a lot of facets of our life. So I think that it's really great that we're getting opportunities, but I feel like we're playing catch up because we're a minority. And we're a minority that's very hard to get the numbers for in a way that they understand. You know, my brother became a naturalized citizen in 2016, and it took him over 30 years. That's the process, you know? And we don't see that on TV. We see a lot of, a lot of immigration stories, you know, and they're always very serious. That's what my brother always said. You know, he's like, they're always so serious. You know, he's like, it makes it seem like if you're an undocumented immigrant, it's like you live in a cave and you just cry all day wondering, like, is today the day? You know, and he's like, I also like to laugh. You know, I also like to have fun. I love my family. I love, you know, and it's interesting because when I hear him say that, to me, it's like, we don't have a face yet. We don't have that soul yet. They treat us like statistics and they tell our stories like statistics, because that's all they know. Now they can see the numbers, they can see demos, they can see reports. But until you make an effort to personally go out and meet these people and understand that we all have so much in common, regardless of culture, regardless of economic status, until then, things won't change. And I think that right now, white men are still ruling a lot of the community, a lot of the voice. I think it's their moment right now because they dictate it. And until we can have other people in that power dictate change, it's going to be a long time before we get that change.
Cristela Alonso is a stand-up comedian and actress. Estela, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
It was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And now we're going to take a quick detour into the basement of Union Hall, a comedy venue in Brooklyn. On a recent Friday night, the room was packed for a night of stand-up.
All right, are you ready? Are you ready for your first comedian? This is who you want to see, okay? Now, she is a writer for Late Night with Seth Meyers. Oh yeah, real deal. She also wrote for the Golden Globes. Give it up for Karen Chase.
My dad is about 5'5", and he thinks he looks like Randall Park. He said it one time at the dinner table, and my mom literally went, "Randall is handsome." A really lovely thing that's true that I've learned from my parents, that I think is the one thing I know about relationships, is that if you want it to work, one person needs to love roasting, and the other person needs to love getting roasted. It's kind of consensual bullying.
At only 24, Karen has already carved out a formidable space for herself in the comedy world. But she's not the only 24-year-old making a name for herself. Ayo Adeburi is a writer for NBC's sitcom Sunnyside, and she does stand-up as well.
It's a tough time to be a black woman. It's an even worse time to be a white guy. No, I mean that. Truly, seriously, to all the white men in the house, I just want to say in solidarity, howdy, brothers, okay? Howdy. I see every single one of you. I do.
And to round out our series, I sat down with Karen and Ayo to find out what the comedy world looks like for young women of color who are getting their start today. And we started off by talking about whether institutions like Saturday Night Live and the Upright Citizens Brigade still hold as much power following the explosion of social media and podcasting.
I wouldn't say that they're not as important. I don't think that that's necessarily true. But I will say, like, as somebody who tried to get through all the levels of UCB and had a hard time doing that because financially, like, I didn't necessarily have the means as quickly or as easily. It took me, like, multiple years to do that because I was, like, doing work study and, like, trying to apply for diversity programs, which they have and which are important, but, it still took me, like, more time. It was nice to not feel like that's the only thing that I had to do, like that I could also be working on my stand-up and it was valid, or it could be practicing joke writing on Twitter or on, on a podcast and, like, meeting people that way and communicating that way. Like, to know that I have additional avenues to whatever a career might look like for me, I think is, like, liberating, especially if you're just, like, from a marginalized background or maybe from a background where it's, like, you show up and you're like, wait, why aren't the things that I historically have known to be funny or believe are funny aren't funny? Why are they invalidated? Why are my references invalidated? Like, to be able to have additional spaces where it's like, okay, it's still good. There's still, like, things that are true here, I think is good.
Karen, what about you? Do you think they're less relevant today?
No, I mean, I completely agree with Ayo. I feel like it's not so much that a certain path has been closed off as it is there are now more paths to get to somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I think that's great because it just means more people can, be at your final destination with you, which is very exciting. I also did a few, like, UCB classes, and I did a Second City thing, and I thought they were very fun. Mm-hmm. I was just more excited by other ways, like the stand-up thing that Ayo was talking about is also such, like, a vibrant community, I think, right now. And free. That was a huge perk.
Free to access, you mean?
Free to access.
Free, you don't have to pay for a class.
Yeah. Right.
Meaning that you guys can get in more easily.
Yeah. Emotionally, a lot of labor. Going to some weird mics in the beginning,
for sure.
Yeah.
But also a lot of emotional labor showing up to an improv class. So it just felt like, this is fine. Like, either way, whatever you prefer, I don't think one is better or worse than the other one. Yeah.
So it sounds like you both had really good experiences on the stand-up scene as well. Or did you consider it also to kind of be a boys' club?
I kind of want to say I feel that way about almost any space I enter, regardless of comedy. Do you know what I mean? Like, if I'm watching politics, if I'm, like, even at, like, a library, like, anywhere I go, I'm like, oh, there are usually more men and there are usually more white men. So when I enter a space like that, it's not like I'm suddenly flabbergasted or taken aback. It's like, okay, great. I've been dealing with this my whole life. I'll just do this again. Mm-hmm. And I will also say that I think there are different – there are lots of different kinds of open mics and there are lots of different kinds of stand-up spaces, and the ones that we see traditionally depicted in TV are very white male ones, which is fine and fair, and I'm sure maybe that was more what it was a long time ago, but I do think those spaces are changing a lot now, and it's really important to keep emphasizing that. So if there are people who want to try, they'll know that you know, they'll go and, like, I or I will be there. You know what I mean? Right. And, like, our friends will be there. And mm-hmm. we're friends with them because they're nice, lovely people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've found for myself in stand-up also that there is just such a great sense of community. And mm-hmm. Maybe this is something that, like, we're experiencing because we're, like, a part of a younger generation. And, you know, there's attitude shifts just in the idea of comedy as a workspace as well. Like, it's, I think it's becoming treated more like that.
Yeah,
and
totally.
Which I think is very exciting. And so there's just a lot of, like, respect and support for people, you know, just being authentic and working hard and trying to do their thing. And I felt very supported by the women of color that I have experienced in that space. Like, you know, Mitra Johari and Kat Cohen and Patty Harrison were, like, putting me up on shows when I was like, I don't know anybody. You know?
Was the first show we did together.
Yeah. And, like, you know, and people were so supportive and welcoming and kind. And, you know, like, I worked with Janelle James on something who's, like, a incredible experience stand up, and she was like, I got you, like, here, if you have any questions, like, if you need anything, let's go. But I've also found that, like, in that same vein, I think, of just, like, respect and growth in the community, men have also been very supportive. And maybe that's, like, not the thing to say on this program.
No, I think that's fair.
I think it's to me, which is exciting, which is, like, I will have friends who are male stand ups, and maybe they do, like, a crowd that, you know, like, might not be as, like, I don't know, like, alt adjacent as I might be, or, you know, might have, like, a different crowd. And they're like, no, these people are going to see you. They're going to be funny. Come and open for me. Come in, into the space. And, like, let's show these people that, like, this is what comedy can look like.
Karen, you also appear on camera in a segment called What Does Karen Know?
Thanks for being out here, Karen.
Oh, God, I'm so excited.
All right, ready? Yes. Karen, I'm going to show you a photo of something, and you're going to try to tell us what it is. Ready? Here we go. First one. What is that?
Oh, okay. Oh, my God. Okay, so my parents had this. This is where you can partly call someone, but you can also fax them things.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a fax machine.
Ah, fax machines. How did that segment come about?
It's very fun. That one, another writer named Matt Goldich came up with it. He's also a stand-up. And our writer's room, everyone is in the same room. It's like this big room that's L-shaped, and we all have our little corners in it. And everyone is extremely kind, and we joke around a lot, and we have deadlines, and after deadlines, we'll fool around and stuff. And one of the running things was, after I joined, if some of the older writers mentioned a reference, they were like, oh, I wonder if Karen will get it. Because if she does, we know this joke is going to land with a larger crowd, I guess. And then Matt turned it into a segment. And yeah, it works. It's a nerve-wracking one because it's completely improvised. I genuinely don't know what I'm about to see, whereas everything else on our show is extremely tightly crafted. But it's also very fun because I'm nervous until I go on stage, and then I go, oh, I'm just hanging out with Seth, and that's fine.
So, Aya, what's the writer's room like in Sunnyside?
It's incredible. It's really incredible. Cal Penn co-created the show with Matt Murray, who is a white man. But every single writer in the room is either an immigrant, the kids of immigrants, or married to an immigrant. So everybody is directly connected with the immigrant experience. Most of the upper level writers are women of color. There's incredible gender parity in the room. There's just so much diversity, and not in just, you know, like, the buzzword meaning that it can often take on. I think a lot of, you know, writers' rooms likes to tout that, like, we have people of color in the room. And, you know, like, the WGA will, like, report stats where it's like, well, now 70% of writers' rooms have people of color. And then if you actually look at those stats, like, 90% of them have only one person of color in them. And I've been in that experience. I'm sure, Karen, you've been in that experience or in spaces like that. And it can be very frustrating and draining, and to have an experience that's the complete opposite of that on Sunnyside is just, like, the best feeling in the world. Like, it's so supportive, and I think we've all been the one person, you know, like, who's been kind of, like, alone in the room, or had to, you know, translate things, or, you know, just do a lot of emotional labor, mental labor. And I think because we don't have to do that, there's, like, so much respect and understanding, and it's just a really fun room to be in. And it's really exciting to say, like, that's what the future of rooms could look like.
Speaking of that, I mean, one of the things that comedy writ large is dealing with right now is this idea that woke culture is changing comedy, and particularly some male comedians have pushed back a little bit on the idea, PC culture. And I'm wondering what your takes are on that. I mean, like, are there, you know, places where comedians feel like they can't go now where they often may have gone before and it wasn't a problem?
I will say that for me, that feels like the strangest takeaway from what is happening. Mm. Like, I think for me and Io, I'm just sort of like, well, now there are so many more things we can talk about. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? There are people, like, I get to go on stage and I feel very comfortable talking about, you know, my family or, like, what it's like being Korean American and things in there that are inherently funny. Mm-hmm. And I think this new wave has really opened up a lot of new voices and a lot of new avenues to joke in, which I think is ultimately only good for comedy. And a lot of stuff that people complain about not being able to do anymore, part of me is like, well, we've seen that done a lot. You know what I mean? Like, I'm happy to go back and rewatch stuff. And, you know, like, mm-hmm. I'm excited to do that. But if I see somebody new saying something that I haven't seen or haven't heard, I'm, like, elated. Like, that's awesome. So to me, it feels like we're opening up new spaces rather than shutting down the entire institution of comedy or however dramatically it gets labeled.
It does get labeled pretty dramatically. Oh, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think I completely agree with what Karen said. Okay, Karen, you were right. I completely agree. Yeah, I mean, the hope would be that you see that and that excites you and you say, okay, wow, like, This is the way things are opening and changing. Now here's even more space for me to play in and learn in and just, like, listen and watch this thing that we love grow and become more interesting. It's also sometimes frustrating when somebody will be like, oh, you're just, like, a woke comic. And it's like, I don't identify as that. Like, why are you putting that label on my comedy as well just because I'm a marginalized person? Like, if you're actually listening to what I'm saying, I don't think a lot of it is, like, quote unquote, like, woke. Like, I'm saying ridiculous things. And, like, yeah, my body is political by nature. So, sure, like, you might attach that to it, but I'd like people to examine that as well. Like, why do you necessarily think what I'm saying is woke or, like, a political act? Like, I'm not, if I wanted to do politics, I would be doing that, but I'm not. I'm, like, operating in this space for a reason. And I think also maybe the upset isn't with us as young comics, but with an audience at large, maybe feeling the same things that Karen was saying, where it's like, we've seen this before, or we don't necessarily like this, or we see that you're punching down. Wait a minute, what's going on here? And they're just not buying it. They're just not consuming. So, you know, that might not have as much to do with us as just, like, the nature of consumerism and, you know, what a comedy audience might want to see. Mm-hmm. I think marginalized people also felt uncomfortable going to spaces and, you know, so you couldn't hear them not laughing at things. Now they feel more comfortable going into spaces because there are shows for them, you know, where they feel safe. And so now they're going to choose. They're going to choose if they want to laugh at something or if they don't.
Whose moment is it in comedy right now?
I think it's a lot of people's moments, which is really exciting. And I think, I mean, this sounds like such a silly way to put it, but if you log on Twitter, let's say you do it every day for, I don't know, a month, I feel like you'll see there's, like, a new star every few days. Like, this person is this thing going on, that person is that thing going on. And sometimes it is a white man, sometimes it's not, and sometimes it's somebody you've never heard of. And I think that's awesome. And you can also, there's so many shows to pick from and so many stand-up specials and stuff to pick from, that there's no real reason to do anything you don't want to do. I don't know. I love it.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah, I think that's exciting. It's like there's people who are going through more traditional channels and people who are taking over alt spaces or people who are just making videos in their mom's house with their mom's wigs. So yeah, I think it's a lot of people's moments and it's going to be a lot of people's for a while as we, like, craft out what our careers look like. I think that's what makes me excited is, like, I love my peers and I love what they do. And I'm excited to be in this space. And I think that energy is felt a lot throughout our peer group. Like, I've talked to older comics and, you know, where they're like, it's really cool because, like, we used to have this sort of scarcity mentality where you thought, like, I could be the only woman of color in the room because you were, you know, or I am the gay one, so I'm the only gay one of the moment. And it's like, that's not true. There's a lot of identities and they're all valid and there's space for all of us to do our different things.
Karen Chee is a writer for Late Night with Seth Meyers, and Ayo Adeboye is a writer for NBC sitcom Sunnyside. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This episode was produced by Ethan Oberman. Polly Irungu and Dina Saeed Ahmed are our digital editors. Our senior producer is Alexandra Boti. Claire McKean and Debbie Daughtry are our board operators, and Jay Cowett is our director and sound designer. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this has been a special podcast from The Takeaway.